This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At some point in the new year, the U.S. Senate will convene an impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. It's primarily a fight between the legislative and executive branches of the federal government, but a third branch will also play a role. Erwin Kamerinsky is a constitutional law scholar and dean of the UC Berkeley Law School. He was recently in Hawaii and spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about the role of the judiciary in the U.S. government and presidential impeachment.
I think the key role of the judiciary is to ensure that the government follows the Constitution and laws of the United States. The most basic aspect of the rule of law is that no one, not the president, not any government official, is above the law. But the only way to ensure that is to have a judiciary to have checks and balances.
How does the check and balance system work as far as the judiciary is concerned? What role does it play in that system of checks and balances?
The key is that the judiciary can invalidate government actions, even actions by the president, if they violate the Constitution. The courts can strike down any government action if it violates the laws of the United States.
We are in a hyper-partisan time right now, and I think a lot of people probably feel that atmosphere has bled into the judiciary, and not just the legislative and the executive branch, because it is the president who appoints federal judges. As a legal scholar, how do you view that? Has there always been a partisan influence into the judiciary? How does the current moment compare to the past in that sense?
The ideology of the justices and the judges is often determinative with regard to the outcome of cases. That's been true throughout American history. And presidents will generally pick justices and judges who are consistent with the president's ideology. Some presidents are more ideologically defined than others. Dwight Eisenhower was not a particularly ideologically defined president. He appointed a Democrat, William Brennan, to the Supreme Court. He appointed a liberal Republican, Earl Warren, to the Supreme Court. But in recent years, our presidents have been more ideologically defined. Certainly Donald Trump and Barack Obama were ideologically defined. And not surprisingly, they respectively picked conservative and liberal judges for the Supreme Court and the lower courts of the United States.
Do you think, looking back through history, right now the Supreme Court, as cited by both political parties, as one of the most important reasons for controlling the White House so that you can appoint judges to the Supreme Court, has there been a period in history any time over the course of the existence of the United States where appointing judges to the Supreme Court has been as much of a political focus as it is right now?
In 1936, at a time when the Supreme Court was invalidating all of the New Deal programs, the direction of the Supreme Court was an enormously crucial political issue. There were other times when it's less of a political issue.
It seems to me in 2019 that almost everything ends up in the court, that whether it's environmental regulation or labor laws or social issues, it seems like the go-to response for everyone right now, whatever side of the political spectrum they're on, is to file a lawsuit in court to try to oppose a policy that they don't like. Is that a relatively modern phenomenon, or have we seen the court system and the judiciary be the first line of offense in the past as well?
It's not modern at all. In the early 19th century, Alexis de Tocqueville in Democracy in America said, there's scarcely any major question in the United States that doesn't ultimately become a judicial question. And there are many things that never end up in the courts. What the president does with regard to tariffs is a place where the courts don't get involved. The president's use of troops in a foreign country are rarely a matter of judicial review. On the other hand, so many key social issues are ultimately legal issues, and thus the courts get involved.
I'd like to briefly touch upon some of the impeachment proceedings in a minute, but before we talk about that, I wanted to ask you about there are a number of lawsuits working their way towards the Supreme Court, it seems, that directly pertain to issues of presidential power, whether the president's, in this case, the current president's financial information can be disclosed to the Congress. And so we have this this tug of war between the legislative and the executive branch, in which the third branch of government, the judiciary, will have to make a ruling. Could you maybe give us an example of a similar incident in the past when the Supreme Court was called upon to delineate the separation of powers, where that line fell between the legislative and the executive branches? And do you think that in this case there will be a substantial moving of that line in one direction or the other?
In 1974, the House Judiciary Committee was considering and then voted articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. While all of this was going on, the Watergate special prosecutor subpoenaed tapes of White House conversations to use in prosecuting those who were involved in the Watergate cover-up. President Richard Nixon invoked executive privilege and said he, as the president, should be able to determine what matters, what documents, what tapes are kept secret. The United States Supreme Court, 8-0, ruled against Richard Nixon, and the majority included three Nixon appointees to the court, Berger, Blackmun, and Powell. The Supreme Court made it clear that it's the province and duty of the Judicial Department to say what the law is. It's not for the president to decide. And the court said executive privilege had to give way to the need for evidence in a criminal trial. There's differences now in that much of the subpoenas are about President Trump's personal financial records, but there's also similarity in terms of, does the president get to decide what's secret, or is that for the courts? In the early 1950s, 1951, President Truman seized the steel mills, saying that they were essential for the functioning of the fighting of the Korean War. And he said he had the authority as president to do this when there was going to be a labor stoppage to make sure the steel production went on uninterrupted. And the Supreme Court, 6-3, ruled against President Truman in Youngstown Sheet and Tube versus Sawyer and made clear that the president didn't have that power, even in wartime.
And I think the last thing I'd like to talk about, could you briefly give us an overview of what role the judiciary will play in the coming impeachment trial? What role does the Supreme Court and the judiciary play in that process?
Well, most immediately, the Chief Justice of the United States will preside over the trial in the Senate. And in the past, that's been a relatively minor role. Chief Justice Rehnquist presided over the Clinton impeachment trial in the Senate, and Rehnquist remarked, he quipped, and said, "I did very little and I did it well." I think in this instance, John Roberts' role could be larger. I think what the senators on the Republican side are likely to do is move to dismiss all charges and not have a trial at all. And one of the things John Roberts got to rule on is, can the Senate do that, or do they have to have a trial? I don't expect that the Supreme Court's going to need to decide major cases that are going to affect the outcome of the impeachment and the trial. The reason for that is there's really no factual dispute here. When it came to the Nixon impeachment, the question was always, what did the president know and when did he know it? Ultimately, the Watergate tapes were crucial in that regard, and they became public only after the Supreme Court decision. But here, there's no doubt what President Trump said to the president of the Ukraine. He said, quote, "I need a favor, though." And key witnesses like Gordon Sondland, Fiona Hill, have made absolutely clear that it was a quid pro quo. Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, said to the press, it was a quid pro quo. Get over it. So the only issue here is, does this rise to the level of an impeachable offense? It's not a factual question. The evidence doesn't matter. It's not really a legal question. It's a question that each senator is going to have to answer.
And is there any avenue to dispute the outcome of such a vote in the Senate, either way it goes? Something sort of like in the 2000 presidential election with George W. Bush and Al Gore, where the Supreme Court ultimately had to rule on who was going to be the next president. Is there any chance that a dispute over the result of that vote could end up before the Supreme Court?
No chance whatsoever. The United States Supreme Court has made clear that the federal judiciary will not review impeachment and removal process in Congress. In fact, the Supreme Court has specifically held that such matters are political questions and left for Congress to resolve.
That was Erwin Kamerinsky, Dean of the UC Berkeley Law School, talking with HPR's Ryan Finnerty.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Pacific Database, Chaminade University, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
It's the end of year, and like other nonprofits, HPR is asking for donations. So why choose our station? With public radio, you know your money makes a difference. When you make a contribution, you help reporters dig into stories that need to be told, bringing you journalism with context and different perspectives. In this end-of-year campaign, the choice to support HPR is a smart one. Give online, hawaiipublicradio.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. And guess what time it is? It's time for your backyard quiz. Among the more iconic buildings situated in Honolulu's historic downtown district is the building which houses the Hawaii State Art Museum. Originally built as a hotel during the reign of Kamehameha V in 1872, it was later converted to a YMCA in 1917 during the First World War, when it was used as a headquarters by the U.S. military. By 1926, the building had become termite-infested and run down and was eventually torn down. In its place, a Spanish mission-style complex was built by the architectural firm Emery & Webb. The new building, which still stands today, features a double U-shape and courtyard swimming pool that, while usually absent of any water, does feature a host of interesting surrounding art installations. Nestled on a corner of South Street and Richard Street, just across from the Capitol Building, the Hawaii State Art Museum is operated by the state's Foundation on Culture and the Arts, and it offers admissions to its galleries free of charge. But for today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the official name of the building which houses this haven for the arts? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you think you know the answer, the first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the realtors and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HPR's commitment to sharing stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
We have been hearing a lot about tree planting efforts this past year, and in our Forest and Garden segment, we follow up with an idea hatched by a University of Hawaii professor to plant trees en masse. The goal by Camilla Mora was to plant 10,000 trees in October. Logistics for the ambitious project pushed that date off, and this month, community groups turned out on December 7th to get more than 2,000 trees in the ground on private property. The planting was largely due to help from the Oahu Legacy Forest Initiative. We talked to Jason Ho'opai about the partnership with the visitor industry that is moving reforestation along. It involves a tree fee that visitors pay in select hotels and resorts. Ho'opai talked about this latest tree planting effort.
we knew we had the land. We knew we could facilitate having his groups come up and be a part of the planting, which is really a part of his vision there. It made so much sense to have us, Camilo, and our organization cooperate on putting those trees on a site that has been prepped, preserved, and dedicated for reforesting. So I think when we connected, it really made a lot of sense. Like, how can we not put these trees where we have space ready to go, where we have an existing forest growing, and where we have people in place ready to manage and care for it? We've got all 10,000 in the ground at this point. It was through, you know, this resounding effort from the community that came out, that heard it on the radio, that saw, you know, heard about it from their friends, and came down to put those trees in the ground. It was amazing to see all those people come down in the droves that they did to be a part of that program. And it was just a lot of fun. I mean, we're out there getting muddy, sliding in the mud. It was tree planting, a little bit of Woodstock, no music, but it was good. We were planting out roughly 20 acres. The property is a part of a parcel owned by the Mormon Church, and it is managed and operated by the Gunstock Ranch. As Gunstock Ranch operates, Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation is a part of their program. And so Gunstock, as a partner, is able to facilitate the management of the forest in its early stages. So they take care of what needs to be done with some of the weeding, the irrigation, and the fencing to make sure that we don't have animals coming in to trample, destroy, or eat, you know, the new crops there. So the Gunstock Ranch people do a wonderful job at maintaining what we've put into the ground and what they've put into the ground. They have a tree planting program there too, and they've done a wonderful job of putting in the forest that, you know, the Milo forest that we installed there over the last 3 years.
So where were we able to get these trees?
So Camilo Moore, he had his group at UH in the UH nurseries there in Manoa, and it was a partnership amongst his volunteers. And so I know some of them came from the garden club, some of them came from the botany club, and other community members and stakeholders within the Manoa community, and people who generally just want to see Hawaii be more beautiful and have more of these precious trees back in the ground. We had ko, willy willy, koa. So, you know, the variety was there, and we tried to interplant them so that they weren't bunched up. You know, we really felt like intertangling those trees in the plantings allows it to grow more naturalized. So we hope to see that result in time.
Talk about the funding for your organization.
I think, you know, because We're a group organized towards, you know, making Hawaii a more beautiful place. And that's, it goes beyond just putting trees in the ground and having that tree look pretty. It's really about creating the experience and creating the value added proposition for the people who support our organization. And so the way that we fund, we've realized that in order to make sustainability something that is lasting, it has to work with the business community, and it has to drive the initiatives that surround both social and environmental engagement. That is, you know, that is a new focus for where business is going here in Hawaii and globally, generally. So
talk about your seed money.
Yeah, so essentially, you know, we create a program that integrates with the hospitality industry, and it's a micro donation that ties into the front desk of Selective Resorts, and those resorts dedicate that micro donation towards putting trees in the ground. So, you know, we create this plug-and-play mechanism for our corporations to meet their social, environmental, sustainability programs through tree planting and carbon offset programs that we tie in, that we like to tie in directly at the point of sales. We feel like that gives it a direct buy-in from both the customer who frequents the hotel, and it's a direct buy-in from the hotel, you know, giving the perspective from management down that we care about Hawaii, we care about sustainability, and it's important that we participate in a program that helps drive our visitors to feel how important and beautiful Hawaii is.
And so is this just here on Oahu?
No. Our first hotel was actually the Hualalai in the Four Seasons and the Big Island. And then we've navigated to Oahu, and we've got some wonderful new hotels coming on board, both on the Big Island and soon on Maui. So we're excited about expanding the program.
So a hotel guest checks in and sees a little fee.
That's right.
How do they explain it?
So essentially, a lot of the hotels, you know, they like to call it a tree fee. And by building in conservation into your product, it tells the customer that this isn't something we're doing, this is who we are. We care about Hawaii, and we're doing this because the result is meaningful, and it's something that as a visitor can participate in. So, you know, like the tree tour, the tree planting tour, we've put in over 500,000 trees on the ground in the Big Island, and a lot of those were put in by people who had loved ones that they wanted to remember or dedicate towards people that they haven't yet met, which has been a really fascinating part of this experience. And so we like to believe that when you put a tree in the ground, we're actually creating a unique relationship between the individual, the planter, and the tree itself. And we do that with a little bit of technology. We've got microchips and RFIDs that we tag each tree in the forest. And so we're able to create a unique identifier for that tree to the customer, the sponsor. And so that's been a meaningful way that we've been able to kind of reconnect people with nature. You know, this is your tree, or this is the tree your grandfather planted for you. That those have been stories that help us develop the program into what it is today.
Do you have to bring bad news, like, oh, your tree died?
Sometimes. But yeah. Generally it goes with, okay, your tree died. I've got a handful of wood artists that can make something really special for you so you can always remember this tree and be a part of it. And I'll put another one in the ground. So for us, we're focused in on building the forest. So if a tree dies, we don't just, you know, cry and look at it. We replace it. And then we do something meaningful with the wood that we can help propel and put more trees in the ground. We've been around for 10 years. It was really born through two very smart people who had a passion to see things change and do things a little different. Daryl Fox, who is one of the co-founders, and Jeffrey Dunster, both, you know, came from an industry where mobility, bottom lines, and margins meant a lot in order for them to do well. And transitioning that into forestry was a kind of a different model than what we're used to here, because forestry here in Hawaii was lost when sandalwood was decimated. And so that opportunity to look at forestry as a new industry is not new. Many, many people have looked at it. Many, many people have tried, and there's been varied results. When we hit the precipice of our environment, you know, hitting the toilet and everybody kind of feeling and realizing that, I think that's when we had an opportunity to transition what forestry meant and what it looked like. And so we're so used to forestry being, you know, planting, clear cutting, milling, logging, building houses, right? We're transporting lumber.
Progress.
Right,
yeah.
Progress, building, right? And the way that we are approaching it is that we actually want forestry to be opposite. We generate money by putting trees in the ground, not taking them out. And so the result is, over, you know, decades of doing this, we will have trees that fall down. And that is sustainable means of timber and forestry. Deadfall is a fantastic way that we can fulfill the needs of putting rare hardwoods back into the market in a way that is sustainable, that is reliable, and that can is 100% trackable and audited, you know, from seed to board feet. So that's really critical for any type of industry in this, you know, close-knit community to work well. This planting in December was crazy. We'd never done anything like this, but we're really excited to explore more about what these mass community plantings look like, how we can get involved between these team members and different, you know, companies that come out in their teams and compete to put trees in the ground. I think that's just a lot of fun. We've got a lot of opportunity to grow with that. And there's been a request to do this on all islands. So, you know, I think we could do maybe a mass planting on all islands, and we do it all the same day. You know, that could be something that's really exciting as well. So I think for the future of our organization in planting trees, we're going to try to put as many trees in the ground as we can. And that's really the right tree in the right place.
That was Jason Ho'opai of the Oahu Legacy Forest Initiative. The group is working with the University of Hawaii on a carbon neutrality challenge to get 10,000 trees in the ground.
I have always been a public radio listener. I like the different points of view that you get from public radio. Because there are two stations and I can always just flip back and forth, it just made it easier for me to just program those two stations in my radio. So that's what I do.
Member supported Hawaii Public Radio. Radio with vision. Listen and see.
Depletion, abundance, joy, despair, fire, water. What truly separates them? Are they really that far apart? Hawaii Arts Lab will explore these ideas in Yin and Yang, a varied vocal performance on Saturday, January 4th in HPR's Atherton Studio. The multidisciplinary show will feature classical voice and instrumentation, and a few surprises too. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It is now time for today's reality check. Our Honolulu Civil Beat editor, Chad Blair, is on the line. He's here to fill us in on the latest developments with Oahu's last remaining public horse stables out in Hawaii Kai. Happy Friday. So tell us about the latest thing.
This is Coco Crater Stables, and you mentioned it's in Hawaii Kai, actually closer to Kalama Valley, really, and just across the street, 10 acres, pretty prime real estate. And Marcel Honore, our reporter, actually reported on this back in April. And in that story, he actually used the word vicious to describe the battle that's going on over the contract to run the stables. And so what Marcel has up today is a follow to that story.
Right. And there was kind of this little feud going between Horse Haven and Aloha Riding Lessons, I think was the other group.
Right. So Horse Haven got the contract, that was the plan for them to get the 5-year contract. But now the city has canceled that plan. They want to get more community input. Instead, they're going to give a 1-year revocable permit to Horse Haven so that it can continue operations. There's a couple of concerns that the city has. One is the Parks and Recreation Department. They want a master plan for not only the stables, but also the neighboring a Coco Crater Botanical Garden. So that's a concern. They want to find some money for this. They want to hire a consultant. But fundamentally, back to this vicious battle, there's a concern not only between these two companies that have been bidding, Horse Haven and Aloha Riding Lessons, but also whether the Coco Crater Stables is really being used in the way it was intended. This is a public riding facility described as the last public equestrian center. I'm guessing that's on Oahu. But in fact, it seems to be geared, at least according to its critics, really for more private use for elite competitive riders. In fact, there's actually 20 horses, privately owned horses, that are already boarding here at a public facility. So that really gets to the core of this. Is it really serving the public when, in fact, according to some, it's a pretty limited amount of people that can use it.
Yeah, so it's interesting because, like you mentioned, it's public land, and, is this just a private business?
Yeah, I was surprised, by the way, to realize the history goes all the way back to the Bishop Estate, when it was called Bishop Estate, and this was back in the 1920s, and the land at that time at Kapi'olani Park was ceded to the city for a very low fee with that promise that it would stay for public use, and then later the stables were transferred, I think in the 1960s, out to Hawaii Kai Kalama Valley. That is a concern. I guess the princess, Princess Pauahi herself, was a bit of an equestrian, if I read Marcel's story correctly.
Yeah, so basically an issue has arisen also because they used to have someone live on the premises, right?
Right. Actually, caretakers for the horses. Well, when that contract was being negotiated, that was something that they said, no, we're not going to have caretakers there anymore. But in fact, there's some confusion as to whether there was perhaps a verbal agreement that does allow, as my understanding, at least one caretaker to be on site. Again, does that violate that concern? One other concern, should Parks and Recreation really be running the stables? Isn't this more something that follows under the Department of Enterprise Services? Of course, they run the zoo, they run the Blaisdell. That's a for-profit making opportunity. So there's concerns there as well. We do know this. The city council wants to keep the stables running.
All right. We'll just have to see how this plays out and then over this next year and wait for that master plan.
Thanks, Catherine.
All right. Have a good weekend, Chad. That was Chad Blair with today's reality check. To read Marcel Henry's story on the Cocoa Crater Stables, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, ringing in the new year with a disco party featuring the music of ABBA at the Hawaii Theater, 7:30 p.m., Tuesday, December 31st. Tickets at hawaiisymphonyorchestra.org.
If you've been to the Big Island, chances are you've heard it. We're talking about the Koki frog. One rogue amphibian apparently made a pest of itself in Manoa Valley this month, but was captured. On Hawaii Island, though, the infestation has been worst in the low-lying areas, but the tiny Puerto Rican critters have been slowly moving up to Kilauea. In this episode of the National Park Service's Voices of Science podcast, we see how they are trying to keep the little frogs out of Hawaii Volcanoes National Park with the help of the conquistador.
So when you look at that, what do you see?
When I look at it, I just see a little frog, a noisy little frog.
For the National Park Service, I'm Brittany Connell, and you're listening to Voices of Science.
I just caught one, so you can see one. Oh, there on the ginger. They love this kind of vegetation. This is kind of how they hang out. You have a search image.
This is Kim Dillman, biological resource technician for Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. And tonight, Kim is talking about getting a search image for frogs, Hawaii's invasive koki frog. Kim holds the frog by the leg. It's about the size of a walnut. She shines her headlamp on it so we can get a better look.
They come in different colors of orange and brown, tan. Sometimes they're really dark and mottled. And sometimes they sort of change their color depending on the vegetation that they're in.
Kim puts the frog in a plastic bag and marks the tree with some flagging. She zeroes in on another frog that's calling.
You got him.
Oh, that's a biggie. Yeah. Okay. And you can see him blowing up his throat, too, when he calls. Can you see him?
In the past few years, koki populations have exploded. Lower elevation areas have been hit the hardest, but the infestation is steadily marching upslope toward Kilauea. Kim is mapping the spread of the frogs inside the park, and she's working hard to prevent them from moving into areas that are currently koki-free. When she finds infested areas, Kim traps the frogs or sprays a solution of citric acid to kill them. People around here have a special name for her.
Oh, the conquistador? I'm just the cokey lady. I'm just the frog lady around here.
20 years ago, the first cokey frogs hitched a ride to the islands on some potted plants, then dispersed into the native forests. Because they're prolific breeders, the frogs quickly invaded the ecosystem. Now the park is trying to eradicate the cokey, partly because their loud calls have become a big problem for the island's residents. But when you hear them for the first time, that can be hard to understand.
It is worth mentioning that in their home range in Puerto Rico, they are cherished.
That's David Benitez, ecologist at Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. For the past 16 years, David has been monitoring invasive species in the park. He says there's a dramatic difference between the native populations of cokey frogs in Puerto Rico and the non-native populations here in Hawaii.
The difference is that they're part of the ecosystem. They evolve there and they tie into the food web and their food and prey for snakes and lizards, and they serve a purpose. Here, it's a different story. Here, there are no ground-dwelling mammals, no snakes, no frogs. Nothing that could really directly compete with or predate on cokey frogs. And as a result, they can they thrive and flourish here and achieve densities roughly threefold what they do in their native Puerto Rico.
It's estimated that in Hawaii, cokey populations can reach densities of up to 50,000 frogs in an area about the size of a city block. David says the sound of thousands of frogs in a relatively small area like this can be intense. This is a pretty big change from the quiet nocturnal soundscape that Hawaii was once known for.
And cokey frogs shatter that quiet in their invaded habitats. They so dramatically alter the soundscapes.
Hawaii's ecosystems evolved in extreme isolation. That isolation created insects and birds and other animals that are simply found nowhere else on Earth. And those species? They evolved in a nocturnal soundscape without frogs. Soundscapes where they could use sound to communicate with each other and to sense what was going on around them. Now, with the native nocturnal soundscape drowned out by the cokey chorus, it's harder for those animals to hone in on their familiar sound cues. Sound cues that are critical for survival.
Research also suggests that cokey frogs achieve such a density that they alter ecosystem properties, mainly the nutrient cycling in the invaded forests. And in turn, those changes in nutrient cycling may further favor invasion by other plants and animals, contributing to further degradation of the system.
Cokey frogs are also voracious eaters.
And that's a problem for the native insect communities and also the species that depend on those insects for pollination or for food, such as the native birds of Hawaii.
They have special ecological areas where they try to keep all the vegetation native, and we're also trying to prevent the cokey from getting there. And those are the areas that we can do something about because they're not infested yet.
Voices of Science is produced by the National Park Service in cooperation with the Acoustic Atlas at Montana State University. Our staff includes Jennifer Jarrett, David Restivo, Sarah Molina, and me, Brittany Connell. To learn more about the park, visit nps.gov/havo.
That was an excerpt from The Conquistador, an episode of the National Park Service's Voices of Science podcast. For links to more episodes, visit our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. In today's Backyard Quiz, we explore art and architecture in one of Honolulu's historic districts. If you've ever explored Honolulu's downtown, there's more than a slight chance that you've made your way to the Hawaii State Art Museum, HISAM for short. It was built during the waning days of the Hawaiian Kingdom as a hotel, yet was repurposed during World War I as the Armed Services YMCA building. When that structure was demolished, a new building inspired by Mediterranean architecture was built in its place. When the State Foundation on Culture and the Arts was established during the administration of Governor John Burns in 1965, the building was repurposed once more as the headquarters for the state-funded arts patronage in Hawaii. Today, the museum itself boasts three galleries with changing exhibitions and a permanent display of Hawaiian art. With over 100 different works by over 100 different artists, the work within HISAM serves as a reflection of the diversity of Hawaiian islands. Not only its art, but its people as well. And while you might think that the building itself is called the Hawaii State Museum of Art, the official name of the structure is, you ready for this? The number one Capital District building. I did not know that, but Alexis from Kona did. She shares with us that she used to work at the state capitol and she used to walk by that very building. Congratulations. You know, that's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting and Island Insurance.
Sean Steinman was working on his dissertation at the University of Hawaii at Manoa when Watermark Publishing approached his department looking for someone to write a coffee book. His advisor let him take a break on his dissertation to pursue being a coffee geek for the book. Now, the first edition of the Hawaii Coffee Book, A Gourmet's Guide from Kona to Kauai, was published in 2008, and an updated edition was recently released. Steinman says the book is an introductory guide to coffee and uses the islands as a case study. While much has changed in the local coffee industry, the issues of blending and labeling continues. Today, a product with 10% Kona coffee can call itself Kona coffee, but coffee farmers want to raise the minimum percentage. Steinman spoke with producer Jason Ubai.
Now, the blending conversation is very tricky. The short version is, as you said, you can have a coffee that you roast and sell. You have to have at least 10% of it being a local coffee to use that coffee's name, that origin. Then you can say 10% Kona blend. You have to use the word blend. So there's some rules, and then the size of the bag, the print, all this stuff. But 10% is not very much. Are you really tasting that 10%? People argue that this is really a marketing ploy. It dilutes our brand. It dilutes the quality. And we think this is wrong because very few industries allow someone to say 10% of this product is this thing. You know, it's like little cans of fruit juice that say fruit juice. And then the back, it says, 3% fruit juice. You know, thinking, it's not a good representation of what I'm getting. So for many years now, a group of farmers mostly in other folks have been trying to increase that from 10 to at least 51%, right? At least say that most of it is from this place. And I think most people can easily agree that's a super idea because then you get more in those bags and you support the farmers more and more of it's moving through and it's more transparent and honest, and that's really great. It's also way more expensive. And if it's way more expensive, fewer people might buy it. And if fewer people buy it, then we have more coffee. If we have more coffee, prices might go down. And there's all kinds of complex ripples that might happen if we increase that percentage. So from an ethical, idealistic standpoint, raising that percentage is a great thing. It's hard to argue with that. Economically, it might have effects that are damaging that we'll recover from eventually, but that transition process could be really tricky.
Exporting green coffee, what should people know about that issue?
Most of our coffee is probably exported, actually. There's no statistics that anyone offers. Individual companies, I could ask, but they're not going to probably tell me. Like the big players. We have some really big farms that account for about half our volume. And you know, without understanding what's happening with them, it's hard to say. But you can look around the shelves and talk to roasters. You can see the vast majority of our green coffee is leaving. And it's really great because coffee is a sort of product that has a shelf life once it reaches its last stage, the roasting stage. So if I were a farmer, I'd rather somebody in Germany be roasting it themselves than me roasting and shipping to them. Even though I lose money in the process, I have a better chance of maintaining my relationship. So this is a big industry for us. It's actually Hawaii's second most valuable crop. So exporting coffee of various sorts is really important. The green coffee exporting is not such an issue except, of course, we want to protect it, right? We want people to know that it is from Hawaii and not actually from Panama. So to really ensure, there's no chemical way we can ensure it. So it's about legislation and paperwork and tracking and integrity. So a farmer who really wants to ensure that the receiver gets what they're asking for can ask the Department of Agriculture, will you certify my coffee and check for quality and check for things and then give me a stamp that says, look, this bag is from Hawaii. And that's how a buyer can ensure what's going on. There are variations to how this works and what grades are being sold and what it can be labeled as in terms of grade. And even to use the word Hawaii has a certain minimum that has to be met for the quality. But very infrequently do we hear problems about exporting in itself. We do hear problems about exporting maybe something that isn't what's supposed to be in the bag, or roasting something that's supposed to be from Hawaii that maybe isn't. And a lot of laws we have are designed to help prevent these things from happening, from our coffees being mislabeled, but they don't prevent them. They just enable the people who make the laws to have the people who enforce the laws enforce them. Right. If there's no law that says you're doing something bad, then you can do it, not be in trouble for it. So a lot of these laws exist so that we can catch somebody. But they have to be caught, they have to be enforced. And it's hard. It's very hard because there's no chemical means by which we can prove any of these things. So it's all paper trails.
I think the first Ka'u Coffee Festival was around the time period that you published the first book. So is any region kind of gaining more popularity? Any trends towards different places? I know Kona Coffee has also been hit with the coffee bore.
What's changed in Hawaii coffee in the last 11 years? Is that the question?
Yeah. Yes.
How we talk about regions in terms of change is really not that important. What's really interesting is the number of farms that have shifted. As you mentioned, and when I wrote the first book, we had no serious coffee pests and diseases. Then in 2010, a serious one came, the coffee berry borer, and that was really tricky to deal with for several years. And I predicted that we were going to see a huge loss of farms on the Big Island and that people are going to give up because this new challenge is going to be too expensive and too difficult. And I was incredibly wrong. We don't have great historical details of the whole process that whole time, but we have seen a big increase in the number of coffee farms we have in the state, largely in Kona, Big Island area. So something magical is happening. It's either driving people here or romanticizing people here or giving people the belief that they can make a go at being a coffee farmer and it's going to be a satisfying and successful piece of their lives. And that's great because we want to have lots of coffee here. People like our coffee. And we like our coffee. So we have a lot more farms. I wouldn't say any area has changed a whole lot, aside from some increase, but the state doesn't keep really good records of how many people are where doing what. And that was because the state didn't have enough money to track these things anymore. So a lot of the numbers that I think about for coffee are educated guesses based on what I've heard from other people, based on what I can see. Everyone's doing better. Some regions are always going to be small, like Hamakua on the Big Island. It's a great place to grow coffee, but just not a lot of people seem to be doing it, and that could be for all sorts of reasons. I could say what's changed a lot since I wrote the first book was how farmers are thinking about quality and how to farm, how to process their coffee. Since Hawaii became a name in coffee that wasn't just Kona, so we're talking early 2000s, late 1990s, people always talked about Kona, then it was Hawaii, and Hawaii was always a specialty coffee grower. We grew things that were good and delicious and special and notable, and you should be able to charge more for it, which we always have. Well, specialty became our way of approaching coffee, or the identity we wanted to have. But within the idea of specialty coffee, you have this huge range of flavor experiences. And if you want to hit the really far end, bizarre, complex, interesting in the cup, not really coffee end, you've got to do new and different things that people have been doing. So when I first wrote this book, people weren't doing very much at all. It was very basic growing and processing coffee. Now, 11 years later, all sorts of farmers are doing all sorts of things to change the flavor and the experience of the coffee they're producing. There's been a real increase, even a shift, in who we want to market our coffees to, what we want them to be like, and what makes us proud as a farmer community. That being said, people still grow and produce coffee that is very similar to what it may have been like 20, 30, 40 years ago. Not because they don't want to be on that cutting edge, but because they want something different. They like something different. So we have as much bigger range of what Hawaii is producing because we have maybe a bigger range of what farmers exist, or maybe because, you know, evolution is about becoming many things to see what works, and we're in this great diversifying phase. As it might not come as a surprise, because I'm, you know, I wrote the book on Hawaii coffee, right? It's right here. It's why we're here talking about this. I'm a big proponent of Hawaii coffee and the industry and supporting the industry. And I've had businesses over the years that sold local coffee to consumers and non-local coffee to consumers. And if there's one thing that revising this book has made me realize, it's just how important it is to support our local farming community. There's obviously a big story there, talk about that, but in this instance of coffee, it's still really important. If we want it to be an industry that's resilient against world politics or world changes or who knows what might happen, we have to be able to support ourselves. We should be drinking as much of our local coffee as we can. It's absolutely more expensive, but there's a connection you have to it, and there's a story to it, and there's the support your neighbor to it. There's all sorts of reasons why we should be engaging more with our local coffee industry. If there's one thing I'd want anyone to walk away from, which is, you know, if you don't drink local coffee at all, add in a cup a week. It's $2 or $3 more than maybe the cup you were buying before. Probably not even that much. Those small purchases, asking for it in restaurants and cafes, is the most powerful thing you can do to help our industry.
It also tastes pretty good most of the time.
It does taste pretty good.
That was Sean Steinman, a coffee consultant and author of the Hawaii Coffee Book, A Gourmet's Guide from Kona to Kauai. And that wraps it up for this week. Coming up next week, Hawaii Baptist Academy celebrates its 70th anniversary. We spoke to one of the school's first graduates from the class of 1954. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Harrison Patino, Jason Ubai, and Pedro Kimura has been helping out too. Big mahalo to Gypsy 808 for recording our new theme music. We hope you like it. We do. The Backyard Quiz intro, thanks to John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.